It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Abby Hornacek.
I'm Ben Domenech.
I'm Dana Perino, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, February 20th, 2023, I'm Mike Emanuel. First, there were concerns the Biden administration was too slow to stop a Chinese balloon from flying over much of the United States. Then some worried the White House was too quick to pull the trigger on shooting down other objects.
The administration owes the American people some candor here. If they didn't handle the Chinese spy balloon in the way that they should have, they just say that. We learn from it.
I'm Dave Anthony. It's President's Day. So with Donald Trump running again, we take you back to the only time in our history when a president who was voted out came back to win again.
On his way out of the White House, he turned to the butler in charge of the White House and said, "Take good care of this place because I'm going to be back in 4 years."
And I'm Jim Daly. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
President Biden spoke to the nation late last week to address Americans' requests for clarity after the U.S. military shot down a Chinese spy balloon and other unidentified objects. Vice President Kamala Harris faced this question on MSNBC.
We wanted to do it in a way that would ensure that there was no harm to the American people, but in a way that we could also preserve what we could then investigate from a forensic perspective. And that's what we're doing.
House Foreign Affairs Chairman Michael McCaul expressed concern about what America's adversaries would think of the Biden administration's response.
It's a sign of weakness, a projection of weakness. The fact it was allowed to travel over 3 military bases with our top nuclear warheads, taking images and possibly sending them back to Beijing, really makes us a bit of an embarrassment to the rest of the world here.
There's also U.S. support for Ukraine as Russia's invasion heads for the one-year mark. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the U.S. is standing strong with the Ukrainians.
Nobody wants to be sitting here a year from now talking about the second anniversary of war. But as the president has said, Shannon, we're going to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. And he means that, as long as it takes.
And on U.S. soil, the Biden administration is dealing with a crisis in East Palestine, Ohio, after a freight train carrying potentially toxic chemicals derailed. Trent Conaway is the mayor of East Palestine and weighed in on how FEMA is responding to the disaster.
Well, I guess they're finally showing up, but I think it's a little late. I'm glad they're coming, but, I think they should have been here long before this.
Now, some are suggesting the Biden administration must be more transparent and direct on all issues with the American people, from addressing domestic disasters to confronting foreign adversaries like China.
Every time Biden or someone from his administration takes the podium, I end up with more questions.
Congressman Michael Waltz is a Florida Republican.
And I still, despite being weeks into this, and as a member of the Armed Services Committee and a veteran of 27 years in the Army, don't understand what our engagement criteria, what our shoot down criteria are to protect the airspace of our homeland. We allow a known spy craft that we tracked all the way from the Chinese mainland to completely traverse the country and complete its spying mission, not just over ICBM fields, but also over a stealth bomber base and the nuclear command and control command in Nebraska before engaging it. But yet now we're going to start just trigger happy engaging unknown objects. I mean, as a commander, I would have been court-martialed had I ordered my Green Berets to start just shooting things willy-nilly without identifying them and understanding if they had hostile intent. So we have some real policy questions from a congressional oversight standpoint, and then also we have military questions because apparently we have a series of gaps in our radars and our sensors that the Chinese have been exploiting for some time, and that's got to stop.
Other world leaders like Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau have also kept their messaging brief, with the Prime Minister announcing, quote, obviously there is some sort of pattern with the balloons, but not disclosing really what or who they believe the balloons are associated with. You think this is because they don't know everything, or they don't want to raise alarm with the American people and Canadian public?
Honestly, I don't know yet. I haven't received a briefing on the follow-on shoot downs, but from what I can tell, I just don't think we know. So I think the administration owes the American people some candor here. If they didn't handle the Chinese spy balloon in the way that they should have, they just say that. We learned from it. But what seems to have happened is that they overreacted from the public outcry and just started shooting anything down that our radars picked up, and now don't just want to be honest and forthright there, and that's what happened. And now that we've called off the search, I don't know that we will ever fully know what these things were.
Okay, let's talk about the war in Ukraine. We're approaching the one-year mark. Your assessment as a former commander of where things stand between Russia and Ukraine as we get to the one-year mark.
Well, look, I have and still support the notion that if we allow Putin to just slice through Ukraine like a hot knife through butter, he would move on and try to realize his stated goal of reconstituting the former Soviet Union. That would mean hitting NATO states. That would drag the United States into it. So if the Ukrainians are willing to do the fighting and dying, and they're asking for the beans and bullets, I think that is in our interest to provide. And we have decimated the Russian military. The Ukrainians have decimated the Russian military with our support. That said, and here's the big but, number one, we need to recognize that deterrence failed. And Biden's notion of economic and diplomatic pressure failed. We should have provided the Ukrainians the military support before the invasion to hopefully prevent it. And that's a lesson we need to learn for Taiwan. The Europeans are not carrying their weight on this. The United States is carrying far too much of this burden, and that needs to change. And then number three, we need to provide better oversight. We need to understand where this aid is going. I have yet to see any evidence that it's being sold on the black market or used for purposes that weren't intended for its original use, but we need to provide better oversight to ensure that doesn't happen. And then finally, we have to watch our own stocks very carefully. Our industrial base, it is shown, cannot just instantly surge and ramp up to produce these types of war materials. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we all recognize that the Chinese Communist Party is the greatest threat to this nation, and we have to make sure that we're still prepared to deal with that.
In terms of U.S. support, the United States has recently provided 31 M1 Abrams tanks to the Ukrainians. What do you think it takes for this war to end, and do you believe there are other ways allies could step in to assist Ukraine in this fight for regaining its independence?
You know, look, on the tanks, I started out as a tank officer, as an armor officer in the Army. They are incredibly capable, but they are also incredibly difficult and expensive to maintain. So one of the questions I've asked from the Pentagon is, yes, okay, there's the providing the tanks, but who's paying for the support, for the fuel, for the maintenance, for the parts, for these very sophisticated machines, number one. And then number two, the type of tank the Germans produce and have exported all around Europe is far easier to sustain and far easier to use. And I really found it appalling that Germany said, well, we're not going to provide it until the United States does, given they're right there on the front lines and everything the United States has already provided. I do think they will make a difference if the Ukrainians receive the proper training and the proper support. And look, the question of how does this end? What is our exit and off-ramp? I have been asking of the administration since day one. We have a terrible habit in the United States of having entrance criteria into a conflict or supporting a conflict, but not how we get out of it. And our policy can't be just open-ended support for Zelensky until he decides it's time to negotiate or he's in a position of strength, because as long as we're providing the support, he's going to keep pushing for a better position. So at the end of the day, I think in terms of long-term support, we need to be putting a lot more pressure than we're putting on the Europeans to step up, as it's obviously directly in their national interests.
We've been talking about China throughout this conversation. How are they playing a role in this conflict between Russia and Ukraine? Secretary of State Blinken recently told CBS News that there's new information that suggests Beijing could have plans to provide lethal support to Russia. if China does get involved like that, how does that impact U.S.-Chinese relations and the war as a whole?
Well, what's interesting to me in that statement from Blinken is when we had indications apparently last year that China was considering providing lethal support, there was very strong language from the administration, stark warnings, talks of sanctions and secondary sanctions on Chinese businesses to not go there in terms of providing arms, ammunition, or lethal support to Russia because it could be a game changer. And now, when apparently there's indications again, we just get barely a mention. So from a congressional standpoint, we'll be asking for exactly what we know and exactly what the administration's going to do about it. We cannot accept a situation where China starts providing its vast, vast array of weaponry to the Russians. That would just be a never-ending conflict and war. And then secondarily, we need to recognize that China indirectly, economically and through different types of technology, has already been providing that support. And again, you know, we have such an incoherent China policy, and I think that's because huge parts of the administration wants to make concessions and wants to keep relations warm, which allows the Chinese to get away with all of these other bad behaviors.
Before I let you go, I'd like to hear your thoughts on another really sad incident that's caught many Americans' attention, what's happening in East Palestine, Ohio right now. After a train carrying hazardous materials derailed, releasing potentially toxic chemicals into the atmosphere and potentially the water, now many residents are concerned for their safety, not sure if they can drink the local water or what the long-term health impacts could be. Federal medical experts have been sent by the Biden administration to assess what dangers could still remain. But what are your thoughts on this situation and how it was handled?
Well, I think it's been just a total failure of leadership. You know, in business and the military and units I've commanded, if you have a crisis, you're there on the scene. You're breathing the same air, you're drinking the same water, you're sharing in the risk. And if the EPA is correct in saying, look, this really isn't that bad. We're testing in homes, we're testing the water. Yes, there's been in some streams and tributaries, some leakages, but not in the main drinking water, which is what the EPA is saying, then why isn't Pete Buttigieg, why isn't President Biden, why doesn't others show up on the scene, demonstrate that leadership, demonstrate that shared risk with the people of Ohio? And that leads to all kinds of questions. So these are just fundamentals, Mike, of crisis management and of leadership that we're just seeing fail left and right. And a lot of people are scared, and it's leading to a lot of questions. And I think they have every right to be scared and upset.
Does it feel like the administration just takes the approach that if they don't embrace the problem, then they don't own it? Like, why isn't Secretary Buttigieg there?
Well, this has been the pattern of this administration since day one, from Afghanistan to the Colonial Pipeline to the border. So I think this is a pattern, and frankly, I think it comes from the top. You know, organizations take on the culture of their leaders. Biden, whether it's Ukraine, where they finally started providing aid, yet before the war, they were saying Stingers and Harpoon missiles and other types of aid were too escalatory, too provocative. They finally got there, but only after the crisis had exploded and reached a boiling point. So that's my best explanation, because I just don't, it's not how I would deal with it.
Congressman Michael Waltz of the great state of Florida, thank you so much for your time. Have a great week.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform, and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
This is Jim Daly with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Happy President's Day, known in the past as Washington's birthday, but then kind of merged with Lincoln's birthday, which was one day later, into this holiday to celebrate all of our presidents. And it comes as the 2024 race gets more interesting. Last week, Nikki Haley became the first Republican to challenge Donald Trump.
We're ready. Ready to move past the stale ideas and faded names of the past.
But Trump still leads most Republican polls.
I will ensure that Joe Biden does not receive four more years.
So our 45th president is trying to become our 47th.
Our country could not take four more years. It can only take so much.
If Donald Trump wins the GOP nomination and President Biden runs again, it would set up a rematch. And those are rare. Edward Larson's professor of history at Pepperdine University.
Once a party nominates you and you lose, rarely do you get a second chance. It's only happened about 10 times.
But only once in our history has a president voted out of office, like Donald Trump was, come back 4 years later to win another term. Grover Cleveland did it in 1892, defeating the president who had unseated him, Benjamin Harrison.
He wins the popular vote, but loses the electoral vote to Harrison very narrowly, despite a fairly successful presidency. And then, of course, Cleveland comes back.
Interestingly, Benjamin Harrison is the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. And Benjamin Harrison was one, maybe the first, to really step out and campaign in a presidential election. It was considered taboo, right? You didn't go out and stump speeches and stuff. You let surrogates go around the country and campaign for you. But Harrison, on his front porch, would have speeches, correct?
He did have a front porch campaign, the first one. McKinley would later more famously use that approach. Harding would use it later. There had been people had campaigned before. Even John Adams went around campaigning in 1800. But it was not like it became later. And the person who mastered that would end up being William Jennings Bryan, who really took it to the people. But Harrison did become more visible with his front porch approach. He had the media mostly behind him. Most of the newspapers were Republican at that time, and in the North, at least, and the West, and backed Harrison. And that helped him beat Cleveland. And Cleveland was very gracious about the defeat, despite the fact he won the popular vote. Narrowly lost the electoral vote, partly because of some added states that had been added. He did go to the inaugural, but then on his way out of the White House, he turned to the butler in charge of the White House and said, "Take good care of this place because I'm going to be back in 4 years."
No way. And he was right. I mean, and he's the only one, because he's the only when people think we have, you know, that Joe Biden's our 46th president, it's really only 45 men who've had the job. And so, because Cleveland's 22 and he's 24. When he goes back 4 years later, 1892, he beats Harrison pretty easily.
Very easily, yes. Partly because of, I mean, for a variety of reasons, but Harrison was, first, he hadn't won the popular vote, and that hurt his credibility. But second, it was not a very successful presidency. The economy did not go well. There were lots of things that didn't work. And there was a lot of nostalgia for back when Cleveland was president.
So Cleveland won the popular vote for really a third straight election.
Except for Franklin Roosevelt. That's the only time it happened.
Cleveland's legacy. I mean, this is a man who was the president of the United States two different times. He's hardly talked about. Why is that?
The second Cleveland term was a real disaster. He should never have come back. It was an utter failure. And he left it tremendously unpopular and totally lost his party's, I mean, his party turned on him completely because he was a gold Democrat. Now, what does that mean? That means he was a conservative Democrat. He was, he won all the Southern states and would carry his own in New York sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. And he held to the gold standard. He defended the gold standard. And we went into a recession, and he had no tools to deal with it. If he hadn't had that failed second term, he would have been much better remembered.
While Cleveland is the only president to lose and then come back to win another term, there are five other rematches in presidential history. And in the first three, the loser also came back to win. First, Thomas Jefferson, who lost to John Adams in 1796. 4 years later, as the vice president, he beat President Adams in a contested 1800 election that changed the way we elect the VP.
because Aaron Burr, supposedly Jefferson's running mate that year, challenged him for the presidency since both got 73 electoral votes. It went to the House of Representatives, which ultimately elected Jefferson president.
But the only reason Jefferson beat Adams was because of Burr, because Burr carried New York. And the only thing that flipped between those two elections was New York. So it was flipping New York that gave Jefferson the election of 1800. And he only flipped New York narrowly, very narrowly. And you could dispute that result out of New York very easily in the second time. But Burr was simply a better retail politician than Alexander Hamilton. And he carried New York. And with New York, Jefferson won.
1828, we have another rematch. John Quincy Adams, our sixth president, he, in a really controversial election of 1824 that was decided by the House in a crazy, crazy situation, he won that race. He lost the popular vote, but he beat Andrew Jackson in the end. But 4 years later, Jackson, he won easily, didn't he?
He came back with a vengeance and just thwomped him. Absolutely right. So that would be an example of when, with Jefferson, Jackson, two legendary presidents who came back and won on the second, renominated and came back and won on the second try.
1840, William Henry Harrison, who had our shortest presidency because he died shortly after he was inaugurated in 1841. He won in 1840. He defeated an incumbent who had beaten him 4 years earlier.
Yeah, the incumbent had beaten him. That's true. So you are absolutely correct. But it's tricky. It's a little complicated because what they had done in 36 is they tried what the Whig Party did, that pathetic party that we had, that every one of their presidents who won would die in office. What they done is they tried to hit from all directions and then win, as they had with John Quincy Adams in the House. It was sort of the Whig Party back then. And so they ran local candidates from regions, and Harrison was the one from the Midwest. So he did run, but so did six or seven other Whig candidates, all against the single Democratic candidate, Van Buren. And so Van Buren did beat the flock. But when the Whig parties coalesced 4 years later, thanks to a terrible depression during the Van Buren presidency, very poorly handled depression, one of the probably the second or third worst depression in American history. Harrison did win on the second time around. But as you pointed out, he didn't last a month. He should have won 4 years earlier. He was too elderly the second time.
We called them panics back then, didn't we?
They did call them panics, and it was a whale of a panic.
1837, right? Right when Martin Van Buren basically took office.
Correct.
Now to the other rematches involving candidates who lost again. First, William Jennings Bryan. He was actually nominated three times for president and lost all three elections. The first two against William McKinley, who you may recall was assassinated in his second term, and Teddy Roosevelt then became our president. McKinley was elected in 1896 and reelected 4 years later, both times beating Bryan.
You know, he was sort of like the Bernie Sanders of his day.
Okay.
He was a populist. He was a relatively radical populist who fired up his party, had the vote. That's why he got the nomination three times. He had these devoted followers like Bernie Sanders did.
Okay.
And so he would run, but he couldn't really expand his base. But on these diehards, he made people leery because he would call for these what seemed to be radical solutions. So McKinley was able to beat him the first time by suggesting that his solutions to the economic recession would bring socialism. And then what happened during McKinley's presidency, not only did you have what turned out to be a popular war with Spain, the Spanish-American War, but also the discovery of gold in Alaska. And that flood of gold into the economy allowed an expansion of the money supply and solved the problem of the recession. So by the time Bryan ran again, we had not only a military victory and the annexation of Puerto Rico and the Philippines, but we'd had we had good times economically. And so Brian was just steamrolled the second time. It was close the first time, steamrolled the second time. But he had such a clinch on his party that he won the nomination again after that and lost even worse.
Yeah, in 1908 to William Howard Taft. The last rematch we had in the 1950s, Democrats twice put up Adlai Stevenson against Dwight Eisenhower, and twice Eisenhower won, and he won easily. So why would Stevenson be the nominee the second time?
I mean, you might have, it's a good question. And he tried again after that. Again, it was a little bit like Bryan. He had a hold on his party. His party really thought that he was the better person, better than Eisenhower. They thought maybe Eisenhower might have been older for a year. He was old the first time, even older the second time. A loyalty of the party would probably be it, blind loyalty, because they didn't really, once Eisenhower was nominated, I don't think anybody was going to beat him. They thought they were going to lose. They thought Eisenhower would be reelected.
And they were right.
Eisenhower, in my opinion, was a very good president.
Another one we don't speak about that much anymore.
I think of him whenever I drive on the interstate system. But he is not, I think he deserves to be thought of more. I think he did a good job.
Well, we've mentioned a lot of presidents on this President's Day. So I thank you very much. Edward Larson, Pepperdine University Professor of History, also the new book, American Inheritance, Liberty and Slavery and the Birth of a Nation. Congratulations on the book and thanks for the time.
Thank you for having me. It's always a treat to be on your show because I always learn things talking to you.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Monday, America pays homage to its leaders as the country celebrates President's Day, the last federal holiday until May. Tuesday, President Biden will be visiting Poland. He'll be meeting with President Duda as well as other Eastern European leaders ahead of the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin will deliver his State of the Nation address Tuesday, just days before that one-year anniversary of the Ukraine invasion. New Orleans and other cities wrap up days of celebrations, parades, and other festivities with a culmination of Mardi Gras. Wednesday, Christians celebrate Ash Wednesday, which falls 46 days before Easter Sunday and marks the beginning of Lent. Friday marks 1 year since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and officials in Kyiv expect the Kremlin to launch a new offensive on the anniversary. Russia has been building up troops and increasing its missile, drone, and artillery attacks. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Rich Dennison, Fox News.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jim Daly.
What's on your mind?
Here's a question I've been pondering. In next year's presidential election, could even the most popular presidents in our history be elected? And would any of them want to run? President's Day originated with a desire to honor George Washington, our nation's first chief executive. Ironically, Washington didn't even want the job. He preferred farming over politics, but he felt a duty and obligation. Washington is considered by most to be the nation's best president. But how would he be received today? Our country's first president wasn't shy about expressing his faith. He prayed publicly and without shame. He didn't take credit for leading America through the Revolution, nor the founding of the nation. He gave God the credit. Abraham Lincoln is also widely considered one of our best leaders. I'd like to believe that a man of Lincoln's solid character and principle would appeal to a majority of Americans today, But I'm not so sure. Even setting aside his gangly appearance, would the experts deem him unelectable, perhaps characterizing him as something of a loser? When you look at his record, it's not stellar. In 1831, Lincoln failed in business. In 1832, he ran for the Illinois state legislature and lost. His application to law school was rejected. By the end of 1833, he was bankrupt. Now, he did win a seat in the Illinois legislature in 1834, but he had his heart broken by a woman in 1835 and nearly had a nervous breakdown later that year. In 1843, he ran for Congress and lost. He won a seat in 1846, but lost his re-election bid in 1848. Then in 1854, he ran for the Senate and lost. And in 1858, he ran for the Senate again and lost again. But in the end, it was President Lincoln who helped preserve the Union and who freed the slaves. Like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln was a man who relied on divine strength. On this President's Day, let's consider and reconsider what qualities and characteristics make for great leadership. Let's consider what matters most of all. No matter what your party, we also need to pray for our nation's current chief executive, President Joe Biden. Whether or not you agree with his policies, as a Christian, the Bible commands us to pray for our leaders. And if you ask me, that's the best way to celebrate this President's Day. For Focus on the Family, I'm Jim Daly.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.